And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matuta.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to be with you. You have entered into the Apologetics Dojo, Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Zone. I'm Gary Matuta. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Ah, boy, it's great to be with you to talk about how to explain, defend the faith with clarity, charity, and confidence. And we have a great show in store for you today. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to be talking with Master Apologist. I know he doesn't like that title, but he is. Master Apologist Ken Hensley is going to join us. Ken is going to share with us, we're going to talk about meaning and materialism. If you reject God and all that exists in your belief is just matter, it's just stuff, and there's nothing that transcends matter, can there be any meaning? Well, you know, Ken's going to come into the dojo, like I said, on the other side of the break, and we are going to talk about that. Explore the area. It's going to be a great conversation, as always, with Ken. Also, we are going to investigate the Finding the Fallacy. And the Finding the Fallacy, since it's Friday, usually Fridays we talk about propaganda techniques, kind of steer away from informal fallacies. And today's Finding the Fallacy, by the way, is called The Big Lie. And we also meet an early church father. Today's early church father is Meniscus Felix. Very interesting church father. You know, it's also one of those obscure ones. So, you know, listening to the program, you get to be introduced to this whole panoply of saints and cool writers. And so I think that's one of my favorite segments. Let's see. As always, you are part of the show. When Ken comes on the show, if you have any questions, give us a call at 888-526-2151. It's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. Or you can also send your emails if you have any questions. Shoot us your email at questions@handsonapologetics.com. That's all one word, folks. questions@handsonapologetics.com. And it comes straight to me, and I answer every email. And, you know, I should also mention, before I do my shout-outs, so, you know, hold on, everybody watching social media. By the way, there's an upcoming live event that I'm going to be on live on YouTube along with Pat Flynn of The Pat Flynn Show and John DeRosa of Classical Theism. We're going to do a huge event. It's going to be basically... apologetics, how to explain the existence of God. John DeRosa is going to give a presentation on theistic apologetics. I'm going to give a presentation on Christ as a Messiah and Son of God. And Pat Flynn's going to dive into Catholic apologetics. It's going to be great. And there's a lot of freebies, folks. Now, if you want to cash in on the freebies, for example, you can get an ebook free just for signing up in advance to this event. It's you get a book that says How to Talk About Religion Without Sounding Silly. Just go to the Hands-On Apologetics website. It's handsonapologetics.com. And what you want to do is you scroll down, and right below the Hands-On Apologetics banner, you'll see a white banner that says, What if we could show you how to never lose a religious argument again? Pretty intriguing. Click on that, and that will take you to the sign-up sheet. And like I said, you're going to get freebies. You're going to get a booklet, an e-booklet, and you're also going to get access to some other videos that the three of us are going to make. So very exciting. The live event's going to be in August. I'll give you more details about that as it comes closer. But check it out. Go to handsonapologetics.com. Scroll down underneath the Hands-On Apologetics live banner. And click on that how to never lose a religious argument again. And sign up, because the more the merrier. And I think it's going to be a super fun event. We've talked this week with Pat Flynn of The Pat Flynn Show. We talked to John DeRosa of ClassicalTheism.com. Both of them were on this week. And as you can tell, they're fun guys and incredibly knowledgeable people. So I guess I'll be the comic relief for this video. live video presentation. So check it out. And now it's time for the shout-outs for those watching live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Great to see you. Ah, hello, Beth. It's good to see you, too. Turn up the volume, please. Really, am I coming in low? I'll turn up a little bit. Anthony, if you could check it out over there, make sure that we are broadcasting at full steam. But anyway, that might be on YouTube. It might not be on the live feed. Let's jump into our Finding the Fallacy, shall we? Like I said, it's Friday. We're going to do propaganda technique. Today's propaganda technique is called the big lie. Now, what's interesting here? Ah, there's the emoji explosion I was waiting for. Thank you. I love watching the live feed on YouTube. The big lie. This expression was actually coined by none other than Adolf Hitler, believe it or not, when he dictated his 1925 book, Mein Kampf, where about the use of a lie so colossal that no one would believe that someone could have invented it from scratch, so to speak. And so if you're going to tell a lie, Hitler suggested, make it a big lie, because it'd be so big that people would doubt whether it could have just been fabricated, that there has to be something underneath it. And I think the big lie is a propaganda technique that we encounter in apologetics quite a bit. Probably more in the last few decades than now. It seems to be trickling off, thanks be to God. Where people, you know, you instead of saying, well, the Catholic Church has a misinterpretation about one verse or another verse, they'll just say the Catholic Church is like this giant satanic organization. You know, they'll make it so big and so ludicrous that people will dismiss it, but you'll also leave you with that unpleasant aftertaste that maybe there is some truth behind it, because no one would say such a thing unless there was some sort of substance. I think that's kind of plays into us as humans. Often whenever we hear something, we always accept it with a grain of salt, saying, okay, well, probably most of that is an exaggeration or someone's opinion, you know, but there probably is a kernel of truth. Well, the big lie kind of exploits that by making a huge claim in order to kind of leave that wandering, you know, gee, maybe there is some sort of substance behind this. So anyway, that is our propaganda technique, the big lie. Beware of the big lie, folks. Whenever somebody makes a ludicrously, if that's a word, colossal claim that, you know, stretches the imagination, just realize that might be totally vacuous. It doesn't necessarily mean there's truth behind it. All right, so moving on from the Finding of the Fallacy, let's talk about the Early Church Father for today in our Meet the Early Church Father segment. And like I said, it's not a household name, but it's a name that I think you should know, impress your friends. And of course, if you work in apologetics, I'll tell you why he's important. It's a fellow named Meniscus Felix, who flourished sometime around AD 218 or AD 235. Not really sure. And the reason for that is biographical data on Meniscus Felix is totally lacking. We know very little, next to nothing about him. The only thing we can say about him was that he was a Christian, he was a layman, he was a Roman, and he apparently was a rather distinguished member of the legal profession in Rome. That's about it. Also, the other thing we could say about him is that he's an author of only one work, which is a dialogue called Octavius. It was, and again, you know, we're not really sure when it was written, probably 218, 235. But we'll talk a little bit about that. But Octavius is an interesting work. It's first, we only have copies of this work in a Paris manuscript from the 9th century, and also as the 8th book of Arnobius's Against the Pagans. So it's like, it's included at the end of his work of Arnobius, and we have this manuscript. That's kind of it. But scholars are united in believing that this is indeed an authentic work of Meniscus Felix. Okay, so we know it's not part of Arnobius. The work is a very gentle character. It's not very polemical, and it has some deep insight as well. Juergens says, and of course we use Juergens' Faith of the Early Fathers for this segment, he says it deserves to be much more widely read than it is at present. The problem, of course, is dating the work, and the dating is actually kind of important. And the reason for it is there seems to be a literary dependence between Octavius and the other early church father, Tertullian's Apology, which dates around 197 AD. Okay, so the question of dating is important because who is kind of copying whom, you know? Juergens notes that the arguments in both works are too similar to be coincidental. They use the same kind of terms, and they develop the same arguments in the same fashion. So it can't possibly be a coincidence. There has to be some sort of dependency. But was Meniscus dependent on Tertullian or vice versa? Now, you might say, okay, that's sort of interesting, but what's the biggie? You know, what's the big deal? Well, the fact is that whoever wrote first deserves the title of the first Christian author to write in the Latin language. So it is, you know, it's kind of cool that, you know, one of the two were the first. In this work on Octavius, he refutes common pagan objections against Catholicism. And those objections are very interesting because they tie into Catholic doctrine. But I hear the music coming up on the other side of the break. We're going to talk with Ken Hensley about, is there meaning without God? Stay tuned, everybody.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
Welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. And if you believe there's no God and all that exists is the material world, can there be meaning in that atmosphere? Well, to help us work through that question, We have Master Apologist Ken Hensley join us. Ken Hensley is a nationally known Catholic teacher and author who, since converting to the Catholic Church in 1997, has worked extensively in the field of apologetics. He's been interviewed numerous times on Catholic radio and television, and on this show, he specializes in teaching a subject ranging from natural Christian and Catholic apologetics to scripture, dogmatic and systematic theology, church history, spirituality, and the art of evidentialist and presuppositional apologetics. Boy, this is a mouthful. Yeah. And he works, I'm not even done, Ken, that's how impressive this is.
I think you accidentally picked that up for someone else.
Well, you work as an online resource and pastoral care coordinator for Coming Home Network, and you can access lots of all the great stuff that Kenneth has written at KennethHensley, all one word, .com. Kenneth, welcome to Hands on Apologetics.
Good to see you again, Gary. Good to be with you.
You know, that is quite a bio, I must say. Just going through it. And you know what? You are the master of all those. Because on this show, we've dived down on a lot of those subjects already.
Yeah, we have. We've touched on some. We have a lot more to go, too.
Yeah.
I think we have about 7 more sessions to get through this one series. So,
wow. Yeah. And it's all good stuff, too. Especially, for those who maybe haven't been following the series that we've been doing with Ken. He's written extensive. Well, actually, you know what, Ken, why don't I let you describe it? What have we done so far in this series?
Oh, well, we've been following a series of short blog articles that I wrote and that were published at the Coming Home Network on the website, on the blog page, and also longer versions in a book that I wrote with Patrick Madrid some years back. We're critiquing philosophical naturalism, the view that nothing exists but the material world. In other words, no God, no human soul, no spirit, nothing like that. No angels, no demons. Nothing exists but particles interacting with one another according to strict laws of physics and chemistry. We're critiquing that. Now, what I'd like to say, I guess, to begin, this is something I've said every one of the lessons, but it's important, is that so far we're not presenting proofs for God's existence, but I am presenting arguments. And that is that I notice that there are things that human beings believe. There are things that human beings, whether they're atheists or whether they believe in God, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever, Zoroastrianism, people believe, for instance, that there is such a thing as right and such a thing as wrong. And I'm making the point that, well, if you're an atheist, though, you don't really have any foundation for believing that. There's no foundation in the materialist or the naturalist worldview for believing that objective right and wrong exists. So we talked a couple of times about morality. Another thing that we tend to believe is that human life has value. We talk about our precious little children, our precious grandchildren, you know, we think human life has value. In fact, there are atheists all over the place who fight for the value of human life out there, you know, anti-war, anti-this, and yet again, if you are a materialist, you don't really have any foundation for believing in the value of human life. If human life is purely an accident of nature, then objectively speaking, human life has no more value than dirt clod, you know, life or pig life or frog life. I mean, dirt clods don't have life, but or amoeba life. So we've talked about morality. We've talked about the value of human life. I think last time we talked about human rights. Now, this is something that many atheists campaign for, you know, human rights. And it's a good thing to campaign for. But again, if you are an atheist, if you are a materialist, a naturalist, strictly speaking, you have no objective foundation for believing that inherent human rights exist at all. So what I'm doing in this series is I'm kind of going through a series of fundamental basic beliefs that we have as human beings, none of which can be supported by the atheist worldview, and all of which, of course, are totally supported by a theistic worldview. If God exists, as we believe, and God created us in his image and likeness, and he inscribed onto our very beings his moral law, then yeah, objectively speaking, we do have value. Objectively speaking, there is such a thing as inherent human rights, as our Bill of Rights says. Well, what does it say? What are the words again? You probably can quote them.
Of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the Declaration.
Yeah, but the words right before it, I can't remember now. It says, we are endowed by our Creator.
Creator with certain unalienable rights.
Yeah. You know, it makes sense if there's a Creator. It doesn't make sense if we're atheists. So we've been going through some of these basic beliefs, these foundational beliefs, and today we want to touch on the idea of meaning, because another thing that we tend to all believe is that life has meaning. Mm-hmm. Right. And yet, once again, on an atheist foundation, life has absolutely no meaning. Objectively speaking,
yeah.
It has no meaning. And that's what we're going to talk about, but in a great deal more detail.
Yeah, that's one of the things I love about your apology, is that it basically says, that all people, whether they're believers or non-believers, have these certain experience, certain way of relating to the world, and yet whose worldview can best account for, those experiences. And so your critique of the non-believer's worldview being insufficient, I think that's a very strong argument.
Well, I do too. This is basically the presuppositional approach, because what I'm basically arguing, you could put it like this, that unless you presuppose the existence of God, you can't make sense of your life.
Right.
You need to assume basically a Christian theistic worldview in order to account for all the things that you take for granted. All the things you believe, all the things you live your life assuming, they all make sense within a theistic worldview, and they don't make sense. They can't be accounted for, to use the word that you used, in an atheist worldview. And I think that is a powerful argument. It's a good argument, and also psychologically, I think it's a powerful argument, because these things that people believe, they really do believe them. I mean, I have a funny story about a guy way, way back, right after I came out of seminary. I was working as a waiter in a restaurant, and I developed a friendship with a young man there who was an atheist. You know, at least he claimed he was an atheist. He presented himself as a scientifically minded atheist who doesn't buy, religious ideas and whatnot. And I began to present this to him within the context of a friendship, to where I could even joke with him a little bit. And I remember he was standing in line one time to fill a drink order at the bar, for one of the people in the restaurant. And I walked up and just like shoved my way in front of him, and when he complained, his name was Tony, and he was shorter than I am. And when he complained, I remember I said, what are you talking about? I'm bigger than you are. I mean, isn't this the survival of the fittest? Isn't that the law of the universe? So what, you're in line, right and wrong don't exist in your world. And,
So what are you complaining about, right?
Yeah, what are you complaining about? And I think I told you, my wife and I, when we were in biology class in college, we had this idea. We didn't follow through with it. It was just a funny idea one night. She was going to go into class, and she was going to sit in the front row, and then I was going to come in late, and I was going to walk to the front, grab her by the hair, and throw her on the floor and take her seat. And then when the entire classroom – I mean, it could have been an entire classroom filled with atheists – when they all just leapt to their feet, in indignation as to the right. Obvious evil I had committed, sexism, evil, unfair, unjust, the whole bit. Then I was going to say, I don't understand. You've been teaching us that we came from animals and that we're nothing but animals. I mean, didn't Tennyson talk about nature being red in tooth and claw? And,
yeah.
And the survival of the fittest is the law of the land. And I read some studies that show that people who sit in the front of a class do better. And I mean, I want to do better.
Yeah.
What's your problem? So, I think this is psychologically powerful, because if an atheist can be led to see that on the basis of his or her own espoused worldview, on the basis of what they are saying is true of the universe, they have to stop talking about right and wrong. Just the rest of your life, just quit talking about it. It doesn't exist. Right and wrong within your worldview boils down to words that we use to describe what we like and what we don't like. And that might differ from person to person, from culture to culture. I mean, Hitler liked different things than you do. you know, but upon what basis do you say he was wrong, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. Anyway, let's get to the issue of meaning, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I begin here by thinking about C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis made an argument from Desire, where Lewis famously said that we appear to have strong desires for things that would not exist if atheism were true. For instance, eternal life, heaven. And he kind of scratched his head and said, I think this is an evidence that things do exist that go beyond nature. Because he says, why would we naturally evolve a desire for something that doesn't exist? Hmm. You know, and I think he toyed with the idea. I'm toying with it by saying, I mean, if you think about a fish evolving underwater, living its entire life in a universe of water, knowing no other existence but water, how in the world would it naturally evolve the desire to breathe outside of water, or naturally evolve the desire to fly? Or can you imagine a fish like swimming around underwater, its entire existence again underwater, and somehow naturally evolving the desire to not be in water?
Yeah.
You know, Lewis argued that the fact that we have these desires, to him, was another argument that we are made for something beyond this natural world. And one of these strong desires that we have is the desire for meaning and for purpose. Everybody desires that their life have meaning and purpose. And what I mean by that is everyone desires that their life have a meaning that transcends just these couple of years that we're given here on Earth. Everyone wants that. No one feels comfortable believing that their life is just one giant accident that has absolutely no meaning.
Yeah, absolutely.
No one. And so, if I may, I mean, I'll throw this out, then I'd like to hear how you responded to it. But I quote from Friedrich Nietzsche's Parable of the Madman, because I think it's so kind of powerful. Nietzsche is referred to constantly as the father of modern atheism. You know, that's what everyone says. He wrote this parable called The Madman. And in the parable, he is describing – yeah.
You know, I think we're coming up on the break. And okay. I don't want you to start right when we're doing it. But that's okay. A great place to start is let's look at, you know, one of the towering figures in atheistic philosophy, Nietzsche. All right, we're talking with Kenneth Hensley about meaning and materialism. Is it possible? Stay tuned, folks. More on the other side of the break. Listen to Hands-On Apologetics.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151. We'll be right back.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Back, folks. We're chatting with Kenneth Hensley about materialism and meaning. And sorry about that, Ken. We came right up to the break. I didn't want you to start the quote and then have to stop. You were going to appeal to or quote from, like I said, one of the heavyweights in atheistic philosophy, Friedrich Nietzsche, right?
Yes. Yes. And the point, to put it in context, is I was making the point that something else that we all tend to want and we all believe in naturally is that life has meaning. And Friedrich Nietzsche, the father of modern atheism, understands the implications of atheism. And according to him, it isn't pretty.
Right.
What he says, though, is logically inescapable, and that is a world without God is a world without objective meaning and purpose. And in his parable of the madman, this is what he says, very powerful. Have you not heard of the madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran into the marketplace and cried incessantly, I am looking for God, I am looking for God. As many of those who did not believe in God were standing together there, he excited considerable laughter. Why did he get lost, said one, or why did he get lost, said one? Did he lose his way like a child, said another? Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage or immigrated? Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman sprang into the midst and pierced them with his eyes. Whither is God? He cried. I shall tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But what did we do when we unchained this earth from the sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving now? Away from all sides. Are we not plunging continually backward, sideward, forward in all directions? Is there an up or a down left? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space? Has it not become colder? Is not night and more night coming all the time? Wow. The ultimate meaninglessness of a world without God is something that atheist philosophers readily admit. And it begins here with Nietzsche himself.
Yeah, that's hardly the feel-good poem of the century, is it?
No, it's hardly the feel-good poem. Oh, wow. That last line, you know, has it not become colder? Is it not night and more night coming all the time? So I begin by just making the point that, you know, consistent atheists will admit that one of the implications of an atheist worldview is that life has no ultimate meaning. And I included a few more quotations here if you want to hear them.
Yeah, I was going to say, somebody could say, well, that's Nietzsche. You know, he was dealing with issues with his father. It was just, nihilism, right? But that's most atheists wouldn't ascribe to that kind of view. Is that a widespread view?
Maybe he was drinking too much coffee and he was just going on these long walks and driving himself mad. But no, I'm making the point at this point that atheists understand that the logical implication of a materialist worldview is that there is no objective meaning or purpose. We will get to where they tend to go in a moment. But yeah, here's a few more quotes. Here's from Richard Dawkins, the author of The God Delusion, probably the most popular scientific atheist on the scene today. He says that the universe in which we live is one with, quote, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's his quotation. Another one, Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, who was a paleontologist from Harvard, very, very, very famous atheistic a paleontologist, in something that he wrote called Why Are We Here? Here's his answer. We are here because one odd group of fishes had a particular fin anatomy that could transform into legs for terrestrial creatures. We are here because the Earth never froze entirely during the Earth Age, because a small and tenuous species arising in Africa a quarter of a million years ago has managed so far to survive by hook and by crook. We may yearn for a higher answer, but none exists. And of course, my first response, Gary, when I read these is, I'm wondering exactly how Dawkins knows, you know, from his study of the biological world, or Stephen Gould from his study of paleontology. I wonder how they know that life has no objective meaning, but they state it as though it's a fact.
Yes, yeah. In effect, what exactly is the scientific test or data that supports the presence or non-presence of meaning?
I know, I was thinking, Gould is studying bones. Did he find a bone one time that had etched into it the words, this was not designed by God. This bone got here on its own.
I mean, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking of this funny stuff that Chesterton said in his book, The Everlasting Man, where he's talking about how scientists seem to know so much about cavemen, you know. They know what they ate. They know how they dress. They know, you know, how much hair they had on their faces and all that kind of thing. And he says at one point, he goes, how do they know this? He goes, did they find a pair of everlasting slacks, you know, stone slacks or a stone derby or something like that? But anyway, it's sort of like this. What would be the scientific test for there is no God and there is no meaning? Well, there isn't one, you know. Right. One more quotation from Bertrand Russell, an atheist philosopher, the most important atheist philosopher in the world. The first half of the 20th century. This is what he said. Man is the product of causes which had no provision for the end they were achieving. His origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and beliefs are nothing but the outcome of accidental collisions of atoms. No fire, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve the individual life beyond the grave. All the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. And then one more, Jean-Paul Sartre, famous existentialist atheist philosopher. He expressed the meaninglessness of human life as well when he said, quote, death is the final absurdity, which befittingly finishes off what the final absurdity of birth began.
Hmm. Yeah.
So again, makes you glad
exactly
you're not
feel good stuff.
No, in fact, he wrote another book called No Exit.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. You know, what's interesting, Ken, is at the beginning of the week, we had Pat Flynn on the show, who was a fallen away Catholic who became a studied atheist. Mm-hmm. And it was precisely this kind of thing where he saw that, you know, where the train is traveling is to this kind of nihilism that there's no meaning, you know, life is absurd. And that was like an important part of him, you know, starting to look into theistic apologetics.
Yeah. You know, that's why I say it's an argument, but you know, I'm using argument in the sense of something that compels, you know, one thing I can't stand, Gary, and I'm sure you're the same place as an apologist, is when you hear people say, oh, apologetics is worthless, no one's going to be won into the kingdom of God by an argument. And I like to say, but everything is an argument. I mean, if you tell your conversion story, you're making an argument, right? You're making a case for the truth of Christianity. If you just show someone the beauty of nature, you're making an argument. You know, so it's kind of loony to say that. Also, people are all different. Some people are one, you know, to Christ by the example of a loving grandmother and nothing more. Some people are one to Christ like C.S. Lewis through argumentation, right?
Yeah, right.
And I know that I was. I mean, at the time when I was listening to my friend who had become a Christian, you know, try to tell me about Christianity, you know, I had in my mind, is this stuff true? You know, I want to know, is it true? And it definitely was books that I read, C.S. Lewis, Josh McDowell, some other people. It was books that I read that made me think, it sounds like it could be true. It seems as though Jesus could have actually been who he claimed to be and who Christians claim for him to be. So anyway, apologetics is part of the whole thing, and this is an argument.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if you don't present arguments, then I think other people think, well, there must not be any reason for your position, that it's kind of just a pie in the sky hope, you know, that you wish it were true, but there's no grounding for it.
Yeah, or you're confirming what I think is the false view of faith that they have, because they think that faith is the opposite of reason. They think that faith is like taking your brains and throwing them out the window and then just like just leaping out and believing something you have no reason to believe. That's what that's how they think that that's how atheists think of faith. And it makes me sad that Christians confirm that view of faith when they say, oh, there's no, you know, basically, oh, there's no argument for what I believe. I just do. But anyway, you know, some atheists, when they take this idea and they really meditate on it and they see the implications, some come to the conclusion that life is an utter absurdity and throw themselves out of windows, you know, and or off of bridges and just want to kill themselves. But that's not really what most do. Most say, all right, there is no objective meaning, maybe, meaning that there is no meaning, that there is no meaning that transcends this world. But that doesn't mean that I can't create meaning while I'm here. And so most take that position, which I refer to as optimistic, the optimistic humanist response.
Yeah, I was going to say, because that's really hard to live a life. I guess he wouldn't say meaningful life, but you know, in that in the light of such nihilism, you know, why even get out of bed in the morning? So yeah, there has to be some other response, you know, some other viewpoint. We only have maybe a minute before the next break.
Really?
So, yeah, I know it's the fastest hour on Catholic Talk Radio. I swear, Ken.
It is.
So what was it called? The alternative view that you coined?
I might have heard it somewhere. Optimistic humanist response. That life has no ultimate meaning, but surely I can create some meaning while I'm here. You know, the things I desire to do, the things I practice and get good at, the people I love, the experiences I have. You know, basically eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die.
Okay, yeah. So the alternative to the nihilistic approach would be we can have created meaning, and I think that's a great place to park it for another side of the break, where we can dive into, well, can we create meaning, and you know, is that a proper solution to the problem of nihilism? Hey everybody, KennethHensley.com. And stay tuned. More on the other side of the break.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Matuta. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Ken Hensley about meaning and materialism. And right before the break, we kind of explored, if you take non-belief, atheism, to its logical extreme, you end up in a kind of nihilism where there is no meaning. And right before the break, Ken, we were going to address created meaning. Is it possible, if God doesn't exist, that we can create something meaningful ourselves?
Well, the answer is we can try. We can try that. I want to say something quickly about the importance. It's obvious that this is important, you know, because someone might want to say, well, who cares? It's not even an important issue. It is important. Another atheist philosopher, his name was Albert Camus, wrote a book called The Myth of Sisyphus. And in that book, he says, judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. So at least to him, he not only thought it was an important question, he thought it was the most important question. In fact, the passage goes on, it's kind of funny because he says, I've never seen anyone die for the ontological argument. Whether the earth or the sun revolve around one another is a matter of profound indifference. He's like, I don't care which one revolves around the other. On the other hand, he says, I see many people die because they judge that life is not worth living. I therefore conclude that the meaning of life is the most urgent of questions. Right. And so, you know, even though objectively speaking, the materialist has to face the fact that life has no meaning. That his life has no meaning, because if the entire universe is nothing but an accident, just some gigantic material accident, and if everything that has evolved since, non-life evolving into life, you know, living things evolving all the way up to you and I on this radio show, if all of that is an accident, it's just a purely material accident, and you don't have a soul, Gary, there's nothing spiritual about you. You're just a pile of protoplasm. And it has got here, you know, as one of my teachers said, you're the forward edge of the sludge of evolution and nothing more. Then your life has no meaning. Objectively speaking, it has no meaning. And people can't live with that typically. So, I mean, a few that see that clearly just throw themselves off bridges. But more people, you know, attempt to resolve the internal tension by thinking along more optimistic lines, you know, and saying something to themselves like, look, okay, in the grand scheme of things, life has no purpose, but surely life includes some really good things, and I can find meaning, I can find satisfaction, if only for a short time, in the goals that I pursue, and the people that I love, in the experiences that I can enjoy. And so, you know, I put it like this, in a blunt, cynical version of this, you can say, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's the cynical way of putting it. But a more nuanced way of putting it, and a more optimistic way of putting it, is saying, you know, live for today. You know, John Lennon, right?
Yeah.
In his song Imagine, you know, first of all, he says, imagine a world, basically, there's no heaven, there's no hell, there's no religion. Basically, he says, there's nothing worth living or dying for. This is what he says in his song. There's nothing worth living for or dying for. But then what a wonderful world, you know, that we can all have living for today,
right.
You know, just sort of finding, you know, finding meaning wherever we can, you know, and that's what most people do. And, you know, the best I can say is that anyone can do that. I mean, I'm like that too, in the sense that I'm not always thinking about ultimate meaning, and yet I still get up and I enjoy the things I do. And I find little meanings in many things that I do along the way. But you know, Albert Camus viewed that as being an escape from reality. This is what he said. he wished with all of his heart, as an atheist, that he could avoid the logical implications, that he could avoid the nihilism, the meaninglessness, you know, of the universe. He wished that he could, but he couldn't. And he fought against it all of his life. And this is what he said. He argued that by saying that life is ultimately meaningless, but that we can create meaning along the way in the short term, he said we are essentially committing philosophical suicide in order to provide psychological comfort for ourselves. That's the way he put it. Yeah. That we're basically committing philosophical suicide. We're ignoring the reality, the objective reality that life has no meaning, in order to make ourselves feel better in the present.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very well put too.
So he said that life is life's absurd. Go ahead. You said it's very well put.
Yeah. I was just thinking, that really gets down to the nut of the issue, isn't it? When you were saying that we could create meaning, I was thinking, you know, it's really not meaning. It's something, it's more pleasure, you know, something you enjoy, rather than something profound and has some sort of intrinsic, you know, orderly to it. You know what I mean? And so it is kind of like comfort food that you say, well, you know, I can make meaning for myself and kind of go through the paces and enjoy myself. But ultimately, you know, you still end up with life's absurd.
Yeah. I've come from nowhere. And I'm going nowhere, but man, look at that lasagna. It still looks
exactly.
Really good. It still looks good. And so Camus, his conclusion was life is absurd. He says, if we kill ourselves to solve the problem, we don't get anywhere doing that because death is just as absurd as life.
Right.
In the final analysis, he says, all we can do really is pursue the things that seem to make life meaningful to us, knowing all the while that in the end, like Bertrand Russell said, it's all going to dissolve in the flaming death of the universe. That's just the way that it goes, you know. And there's you know, in a way, as I'm thinking about this again, I'm realizing that this applies to all the subjects we've talked about, and that is that there is no objective right and wrong, but we can kind of dream up our own right and wrong in this life in order to get by. Because we would all kill each other constantly if we lived out objectively the idea that there's nothing right, there's nothing wrong, and there's no meaning in life. You know, again, I've come from nowhere. I'm only here for a little while, so I'm going to get whatever I want. I'm going to rob banks. I'm going to kill people. I'm going to steal, you know, the purse from an old lady, you know, as I knock her down crossing the street. You know, in a way, this applies to all of those subjects. There is no objective value to human life. But I'm going to create value and pretend that there is value so that I can live. People don't really have inherent human rights, but I'm going to dream them up and pretend that people have rights. It's like God made us in his image. And so we know these things really are true. And so we want to live according to them, even if our philosophy completely contradicts them.
Yeah. And I suppose that's why John Lennon's song, Imagine, the title is so apt because it really is a kind of imaginary world.
No, you're right. I've never thought of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I personally think it should be like an atheistic national anthem because it really does encapsulate it. But yeah, so if both of these paths are kind of lead you to a dead end where you have to kind of parasitically borrow things from theism, this opens up the possibility of evangelism, doesn't it? Because we do have an answer.
Yes, you open the catechism to the Catholic Church, and very early. In fact, I've noticed that if you look at like part one, chapter one, you know, right at the beginning, you read paragraph 27, the desire for God is written in the human heart, because man is created by God and for God, and God never ceases to draw man to himself. Only in God will he find the truth and happiness he never stops searching for. You know, it's like right away, a totally different worldview is presented.
Right.
It is quite amazing. And you're right. It opens up the door to evangelism because you can, in talking to someone, again, you may not be proving, you know, in terms of like a mathematical or philosophical proof, logical proof. You may not be proving that God exists, but you certainly are putting your finger on a point of massive tension in the life of the atheist. If you can talk about the atheist's desire for meaning in his own life, in her own life, and you can talk about how the atheist worldview can't support it at all, but guess what? A theistic Christian worldview completely makes sense of it. It makes sense of it being true that there's meaning, and it makes sense of why you even want it. It makes sense. You know what I'm saying, Gary?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a question for you then. So if you're talking to a non-believer and you want to use this approach, or should you use this approach? Is it important to lead them to the natural conclusion and then, you know, show how our worldview makes more sense? Or, you know, is this a tactic that that should be used, you know, as a main tactic or something, you know, later on? Or
I'm not sure if I can answer. The reason I can never answer questions about tactics is that every person you talk to is a different person.
Yes, that's true.
And you're always having to think, what, you know, who is this person in front of me and what will work, you know? What is best? But, you know, I think about the fact that the old preachers used to always say, no one will understand the good news unless you lead them to understand the bad news first.
Right.
And so, you know, yeah, I don't think that jumping up and saying life has meaning as a Christian makes a lot of sense unless the atheist first sees that life has no meaning according to his worldview. So it's probably best to go that direction, although it's going to be different with every person. You know, when I think about this, not only does our worldview as Catholic Christians provide objective meaning, but it even explains to me why this atheist wants meaning, because he's made in the image of God, and like the Catechism says, the desire for God is written into the human heart. So it explains to me why he wants meaning. It explains to me why he can't find meaning based on his worldview. I mean, it explains everything.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a proof. Someone could say, oh, well, great, you dreamed up a worldview that explains everything, but that doesn't mean it's true. And that's why I'm saying this isn't a proof. But it's a powerful argument, especially if you're able to talk about not just this, but the other things we've talked about. If you're able, in a sense, to walk someone through understanding that all of these fundamental things that they take for granted and believe and live according to and all that, that none of them have any legs to stand on in an atheist worldview.
Yeah, very good. Wow, I can't believe the hour is gone. Time flies when you're having fun. So, Ken, where can people go to access your work?
Oh, real quick. Most of my written stuff is at the Coming Home Network blog site, which you'd have to search through, or on the pages of the Coming Home Network website. My recorded talks are at KennethHensley.com.
Okay,
again,
very
Gary.
Good. Yeah, well, thank you so much for coming on. Well, it's hard to believe the hour is over, folks. Coming up next, Dynamic Catholic Talk Radio coming at you with the Terry and Jesse Show. And it's time for me to shut down the Midwest Command Center here, turn off the dojo lights. Well, thank everybody for listening to the program. And God willing, we'll talk again tomorrow. Everybody have a great and blessed day. Bye-bye.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.